A representative explained why the ban would set a dangerous precedent.
Since the referendum was already signed by more than 100,000 voters to be even admitted at the to the ballot, and a recent poll suggests that 64% of voters will vote in favor of a ban, the law is highly to be passed. Adding such an Islamophobic and discriminatory ban to the Swiss constitution, which dictates to women how they should dress, exposes Switzerland to internal, or I would say international, ridicule, and fundamentally contradicts the liberal and pluralistic values that this country is so fond of propagating. And if we were to ban everything that might been out of force, then we would most likely ban a lot of things and not only the niqab.
Islamophobia has penetrated deep into Swiss society, with a recent poll finding that 63% of those questioned would vote in favour of a burqa ban, leaving Swiss Muslims with little hope. Robert Carter, London.
The American aggression and the blockade on Yemen are terrorist crimes is the motto of a press conference held by the Intisaf, Organization for the Rights of Women and the Children. The conference highlighted the crimes and violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition against Yemeni children and women with American support.
The crimes and violations committed by the U.S. against the people of Yemen are too many and cannot be counted. There is, for example, the crime of targeting children in Dahyan in Sada, and the crime of targeting women in weddings in Wajiha, Ahrab, and Samban, and these are war crimes for sure.
The Minister of Human Rights said that designating Ansarullah as a terrorist organization confirms that the American participation went beyond arms sales, military and logistical support, and reached providing political cover and justify the crimes of its Saudi ally.
The classification of Ansarullah as a terrorist organization is an American green light for Saudi Arabia to continue its aggression against Yemen, and also to feed terrorism and terrorist groups, as happened in Al-Baidah. When the Yemeni army found weapons with the logo of the United States Agency for International Development, and also for the sake of covering and evading its crimes in Yemen.
The Saudi war on Yemen has killed hundreds of thousands of people and displaced millions of others. The country is suffering from a humanitarian situation that was described by the United Nations as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Yemenis unanimously agree that the U.S. is a major complicit in the war crimes committed against Yemeni children and women, which necessitates placing its name on the top of the list of states sponsoring terrorism. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana.
The UK has used slogans to raise awareness during the pandemic. One of its most popular is Stay Home, Protect the NHS, Save Lives. Some government messaging has been comforting as well as informative, but it's become more and more intense, with TV ads showing people dying and incessant radio ads claiming joggers and people working outdoors are highly likely to have the disease.
Stick to the rules. If you bend the rules, people will die. Stay home, protect the NHS.
The government is now under pressure to pull this ad after Number 10 was condemned by MPs and public health experts for spreading false information. Parents worry they will affect their children. Surely this messaging could be really damaging to vulnerable people and is irresponsible. Telling five-year-olds if someone bends the rules, people will die seems really inappropriate. We need sensible messaging. They should not be saying people will die. We are heading for a huge mental health crisis in this country. And experts agree. 10 of the UK's top experts in child health say anxiety, self-harm, and suicidal thoughts have reached frightening levels among children. Paediatricians are urging the government to reopen schools or risk a calamitous impact on children's mental health. Boris Johnson says he understands the concerns surrounding the mental health of young people, but it all relies on the vaccine.
If we achieve our target of vaccinating everyone in the four most vulnerable groups with their first dose by the 15th of February, and every passing day sees more progress towards that goal, then those groups that have developed immunity from the virus about 3 weeks later, that is by the 8th of March. We hope it will therefore be safe to begin the reopening of schools from Monday, the 8th of March.
Adults themselves are struggling. There has been a surge in people afraid to leave the house. Alcohol consumption has gone up, and helplines say calls regarding domestic abuse have increased many times over.
Health services in the UK say as a result of the pandemic, at least 10 million people are going to need some form of mental health support. And with no real end in sight for the lockdowns and the virus itself, more and more people are losing hope. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Iranian cultural figures, artists from different countries as well as envoys of the foreign states attended the closing ceremony of the biggest calligraphy event, which was held in Jondi Shapur Library west of Tehran. Some of the artists also performed calligraphy live while the audience could watch their expertise. The exhibition aims at convening countries which have olden historical civilizations. Artworks from Silk Road countries including Pakistan, Egypt, India, Tajikistan, Iraq, Tunisia, Algeria, and Afghanistan were put on show both virtually and also physically with limited number of visitors due to the pandemic. The organizers noted that as the works were in different languages, it was not possible to judge them.
Iranian National Commission for UNESCO decided to hold this festival to enhance cultural proximity among countries. We started the preliminary phases since 1.5 years ago. Almost 1,000 works from different countries were received by the Secretariat. As the works were written in different languages, we could not judge them. So we decided to choose the winners randomly.
Veteran calligraphers also noted that calligraphy is a heritage that must always be preserved. Calligraphy works by 203 artists from 30 countries have been showcased in the exhibition, which officially opened on January 20th in the northeastern Iranian city of Mashhad, Humam Abadi, Tehran.
With the new U.S. administration taking the helm at the White House, many express optimism that the 2015 Iran nuclear deal will be back on the board. But comments by U.S. officials have raised doubts over the optimism. On Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Washington will meet its commitments under the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, only after Tehran returns to full compliance with the JCPOA. Blinken said the U.S. wants to start meeting its obligations again, but Iran needs to act first. He said Washington would seek to build a longer and stronger accord to address what he called deeply problematic issues. He, however, noted that it will take a long time for the U.S. to return to the deal. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif was quick to react, saying it is the United States that should return to its obligations under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal first. Zarif recalled it was Washington who violated the nuclear agreement, prevented supplies of food and medicine to Iran, and punished countries which abided by UN Security Council Resolution 2231. Therefore, it's the U.S. that should take the first step. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled his country out of the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Tehran as part of his so-called maximum pressure policy against the Islamic Republic. Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories, Britain, France, and Germany, to make up for the U.S. move. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments. Iran then reacted by scaling back on its commitments under the accord. Tehran says it has lost trust in the Western members of the deal, and it will only revoke its measures after the U.S. removes its sanctions. On Tuesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov echoed a similar position, stressing that the United States must remove its sanctions against Iran and comply with the 2015 nuclear deal, as it was Washington that withdrew from the accord. Some experts say Biden has been a warmonger and is not going to return into a pacifist overnight.
I mean, the point being that virtually everything he has done has been imperialist. He's a chief warmonger for the U.S. government. He is not going to turn into a pacifist and and a logical statesman who cares about the well-being of people in the world. I mean, he's just never done that. And he's always been intimate with the defense industry. He has long-standing ties with the defense industry.
With the Biden administration not showing any practical and real interest in returning to the deal, questions arise as whether he will follow in his predecessor's track and maintain his anti-Iran pressure campaign, or will it put an end to its malign policy against Tehran, as Iran foreign minister put it. Iran, on the other hand, says the window of opportunity is closing very fast.
The steadfastness of Yemen and the resistance of Palestinians is the slogan of a press conference held by the Yemen-Palestine Organization. Participants discuss Yemeni-Palestinian relations and their common vision, which is resistance against the Zionist projects in the region.
This event is a Yemeni-Palestinian initiative for political awakening and for the unity of both nations to achieve a common goal of defeating the Israeli regime's plans in the region and liberation of Palestine. Israel is our common enemy and the enemy of Muslim nations.
The participants affirm that Yemen and Palestine have strong ties that transcend geographical borders, as Yemen has become an important part of the axis of resistance. The Yemen-Palestine Organization also revealed its humanitarian plan for 2021, which will contribute to alleviating the suffering of Yemenis due to the continuing war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition.
Yemenis believe that the U.S., as the main supporter of Israel, is also responsible for the sufferings of Palestinians and Yemenis. They say resistance is the only way to achieve victory and liberation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi,
Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. tongues fall silent before the limit of describing him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terence fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him, and everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Although the new U.S. administration hasn't been in power for long, it has already shown that China is its target. Well, the Biden administration seems to be picking up where the Trump administration left off. However, with more of an aggressive military face towards Beijing, the U.S. says China is being aggressive with Taiwan flying military planes over the island. Beijing says there is one China, and Taiwan is part of it. Stay with us as we take a look at this on this debate.
Less than a month after a new administration took the helm of the White House, the United States and China still seem to be at each other's throats. The new U.S. Secretary of State during the Senate confirmation hearing was one of the first Biden administration officials to have tough words for China.
My view is we have an abiding and longstanding and bipartisan commitment to Taiwan and to the Taiwan Relations Act. We need to make sure that they have the means to deter aggression, to defend themselves. I'd like to see them, Taiwan even more engaged in the world.
On Friday, the new White House National Security Advisor echoed the top diplomat's words about Beijing.
And then the last piece is speaking with clarity and consistency on these issues and being prepared to act as well to impose costs for the what China is doing in Xinjiang, what it's doing in Hong Kong, for the bellicosity of threats that it is projecting towards Taiwan.
While the United States does not officially recognize the independence of Taiwan, it has extensive ties with the island and has promised its support in case of a military showdown with mainland China. Beijing has time and again warned Washington to refrain from ties with Taiwan. China and the United States are also at odds over the South China Sea. Beijing claims the energy-rich waters almost in its entirety, but countries such as the Philippines and Vietnam lay overlapping claims. Washington has promised to stand with those Southeast Asian claimants. But the tensions between the two countries do not stop here. China and the United States have also been engaged in a bitter and costly economic rivalry. The trade war reached a peak under the former U.S. president. During Trump's term, China and the United States imposed tit-for-tat tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars worth of goods. Now all eyes are waiting to see how the ties between the world's two biggest economies would develop. Will tensions cool with a new president at the White House, or will the war of words continue and possibly get even worse? Only time can tell.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, Emeritus Professor, University of Wisconsin, Frank Imsbach, out of Madison, a Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, George Zimbabwe, out of Budapest. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off in Madison. Your take on this, why are we seeing such aggressive words so early on from the Biden administration against China?
Well, first of all, let's talk about the overall framework. We're talking about a framework in regards to Taiwan that was announced in 1949 when the Chinese communists at that point had won the Civil War. A remnant had retreated of the right wing, retreated to Taiwan. And so that issue was the Cold War issue, you know, who lost China. And we have never moved off of that model. So this is 80 years later or whatever. So the whole framework doesn't make any sense anymore in that regard. In terms of the most immediate thing, the Democrats have always felt on the defensive about China since 1948. When they were charged with losing China, you know, and so they have always been had this sort of reaction. Plus, there's a deep-seated, and I think somewhat hidden, but deep-seated anti-Chinese bias here from 1880. You know, so what is the situation now? The situation now, for the first time in 150 years, is that the United States may no longer be the top dog. You know, China's a big place. There's a lot of people there. There's a lot of things going on technologically. And so I think these types of deep-seated feelings, the notion of being maybe pushed out of the top perch, all feed into this.
Okay. What about that, George? Let me get George in on this conversation. George, what about that, what Frank has just said? Is that the main problem as far as relations between China and the United States, is that basically China is in the process of overtaking the United States as the largest economy, and also from a technological perspective, many say that actually Beijing will overtake the United States very soon. Your take?
I think so. And historically, there's no question that great powers do not cede their place to an upcoming rival power peacefully. That has always been the case. We remember what happened with when Germany emerged as the great power towards the end of the 19th century and early 20th century. And something like that is happening today. It's not just that China is overtaking the United States in terms of the size of its economy, but that China is exerting its influence in the world and using its economic and financial power to exert its influence and creating alternative economic models to the Washington consensus. So when it comes to things like the Belt and Road Initiative, and whereby it's investing in other countries are now finding China as being a rather more attractive economic partner than that of the United States, because for one thing, China interferes much less in the internal affairs of other countries than does the United States. So well, that's been the case hitherto. So what's happened now is that not only has China overtaken the United States and is exerting its economic influence and it's creating an alternative reserve currency, an alternative financial and banking system, but it has a very close ally with Russia, which, though not an economic giant by any means, has a very substantial strategic arsenal and seems to have overtaken, for the first time since the end of World War II, seems to have overtaken the United States in terms of its strategic nuclear arsenal. So when you combine that together, this is causing a great deal of anxiety in Washington. And as I said, historically, great powers react with violence when they find that their position has been pushed aside.
What about that, Frank? Do you agree with George? And if you do, what type of scenario does that set up in general?
Well, first, in today's Wall Street Journal, there's a number of articles about General Motors agreeing to or announcing they're going to be making all electric cars in 2035. The article goes on to state that essentially we're following the Chinese model. The Chinese, through their organization of the car industry at this point, as the largest single market in the world, are essentially going to be calling the shots. Now, think about that in terms of global power, the automobile, the United States, all that symbolism, what that means. So that was the Wall Street Journal's estimate, to back up what my colleague in Budapest said. In terms of the future, nuclear war is unthinkable. That's the problem here. And so if you continue to stoke this without figuring out alternative means of settling this problem, we're done as a human race. And I think some recognition of that. But I think that we, as normal people, have to begin to say moving down this path, in spite of history, is the wrong way to go, because it's going to lead to nothing. It's going to lead to destruction. And I think we really need to begin to say that
okay.
to people.
Well, wouldn't it be, George, wouldn't it be more beneficial for both countries and the world if the U.S. and China work together? Of course, we understand the rivalry. But basically, I mean, if we look at the situation, we look at, for example, the United States is the largest consumer economy, country, and of course, China is the largest manufacturer. So they're a symbiotic relationship that they actually need each other. What do you think it will take to have them, instead of basically coming face to face with this conflict, being able to actually work better together? Is that a possibility?
Well, one would hope that that's a possibility. But there are a lot of economic issues that divide the two countries. And one of it is certainly unfair trading practices. I mean, the United States has, particularly under Trump, issued a whole series of demands upon the Chinese to engage in fairer trade practices. They've talked about, lack of access to the Chinese market. They've talked about intellectual property theft. And what's now, and this is emerged as a big issue, is of course also the virus. Because right in the last days of the Trump administration, I mean, basically they've accused China of, almost accused them of deliberately infecting the world with the virus. Now, even if the Biden people pull back on some of those accusations, they're not just going to go away just like that, because first, one thing, this virus is a big, very big deal. I mean, if you lose, you know, maybe 20-25% of your economy as a result of this pandemic, then you really want to say, we want to make sure that nothing like this happens again, and therefore, what exactly is China doing about addressing this issue to make sure that nothing like this happens again? And to be honest, China has failed to come up with any plausible explanation. So therefore, this is going to rankle for quite some time.
Frank, your take on that. What do you see as the main issues? Now, George has also talked about the pandemic itself. Your take on the main issues that really separate the U.S. and China?
I think it's the overall question of who's in charge. Clearly, there are individual economic issues, whether it's patents or battery production or who's got the lithium. And also, the virus adds a much greater complicating factor. It's easy for us to blame the Chinese. You know, that's a pretty simple thing. When, in fact, there have been several viruses in the last several years, most of them not coming from China. There's a whole development of agriculture, the way things are done, all of which lean towards that we're going to have more of this problem. So just to blame the Chinese scientifically doesn't make much sense. But politically, that's another story. And there, it did work for the Trump administration for a while. But I think, again, you're going to have some leadership here on the part, certainly, of my country, which I can speak about, and I hope in China, where people actually take a deep breath and step back and say, where can we work things out? Because going down the current pathway of saying, well, Taiwan really is independent and we're going to defend it to the death, well, who's death here? Mm-hmm. And what is going to happen? And I don't think that is a viable long-term pathway, either economically or politically.
Well, Frank, let me stay with you because I want to talk about the American side of this. It is quite difficult for Americans not to see themselves as number one. Can the U.S. actually deal with that in a non-militaristic way? Because so far what we see is the U.S. flexing its muscles. And basically, how did the U.S. get here? Because the U.S. had the largest economy. Technologically, the U.S. Was seen as number one. What exactly happened to the United States in your perspective?
Well, we got here because of World War II, so to speak. I mean, when we're talking about the United States saying that we're on the defensive, when we have an aircraft carrier parked outside of China and another one parked outside of your country, and that's our defensive perimeter, and anybody that fools with that is the aggressor, well, that's quite a stretch, you know, 3,000 miles away, and we take the position that this is okay, that we have the right to be in the Western Pacific and the Gulf and so forth. So it's going to take quite a bit of rethinking here, and it's not clear to me that there are the forces available or mobilized to begin that rethinking. So I think this is a very dangerous situation. What we're left with are people with great economic interest in not having a war with China. And I think that's a very important thing, but I'm not sure it's sufficient.
What about you, George? What do you think as far as rethinking it? Do you think that the United States, first of all, is ready to rethink their policy? Now, Frank talked about post-World War II and how the perimeters continue to expand as far as the United States and its interests. Basically, did the United States wound itself by putting so much emphasis on the military, or your assessment of the situation?
Well, military power is, of course, a key to U.S. power in the world, but, of course, in other aspect of it was through the use of the dollar as the reserve currency. I mean, it was able to coerce countries through its dominance of the dollar. With China, although it doesn't really equal the United States as a military power, nonetheless, in terms of its financial power, it will indeed very soon be able to challenge the dollar. And unfortunately, the United States hasn't used its power with the dollar as intelligently as it should have done. And that's why I think many countries will be very happy to see an alternative to the dollar. But when it comes to military power, I think that what the United States is trying to do is using its economic, its military muscle in order to coerce China to make concessions, to make economic and financial concessions. So I think that that's, I think, the role. So why is China, the United States bringing up issues like Taiwan and Hong Kong and the treatment of the Uyghurs? In other words, they're all matters that are internal in China, and even the whole issue of the, what's going on in the South China Sea and the East China Sea. I mean, you know, these aren't really issues that affect United States security in any way, but they are being used by the Americans to coerce China. So in other words, you know, to get concessions out of them in other spheres, because I think that the United States wants to make sure that it retains its economic dominance. I mean, it's pretty sure about its military dominance, but it's economic dominance that is under challenge.
Well, Frank, with the U.S.'s descent from power, how aggressive do you see Washington becoming during this process?
Well, I'm not sure how aggressive it's going to become. Here's one of the problems. You have, in order to deal with China or the rest of the world, the United States is going to have to decide if we're interested in controlling investment and interested in what we call mobility of capital. China became the number one destination for foreign investment over the last quarter, for the first time ever, surpassing the United States. That's a big deal, because people are saying, well, invest there. The United States depends on foreign investment to maintain its economy and like every place else. So you begin to see that cannot be solved militarily. And that's a problem for the United States, because we put all of our eggs really in the military basket. And so that's one aspect of this. The other thing is, yes, the economic part. So far, the tariffs have cost the United States way more than they have cost the Chinese. Mm-hmm. So that didn't work out so well. And I think that, you know, to go down the road of conflict here, both economic and military, is not going to yield a solution that's positive for the United States or probably anybody else. So I think there really has to be a rethinking of this. And it is real new territory for the United States, because we're not going to be able, apparently, to say, do this. And the other people are going to say, yes. The Chinese have said, no, we're not going to do that. And so I think that this is really new territory, and I don't see with the president's Obama administration, but actually almost all the Biden people are old Obama folks,
right.
Don't see any kind of basic rethinking going on here.
Well, what do you think, George? How likely are we to see a military conflict between these two powers?
Well, one would like to think that it's unlikely. However, I tend to think that the Biden people will probably emphasize the military aspect of the conflict with China more than the economic aspects. I mean, I don't think they're as preoccupied with the economic questions as the Trump administration was. I mean, that really was an important ingredient of Trumpism, which was to use tariffs in order to essentially build up America's industrial base at home. That was the goal of Trump. That isn't really the goal of the Biden people. I don't think they think in those terms. And it's certainly, given the corporate and financial interests that are very close to the Biden people, I don't think that they're going to pursue that goal with anything like the vigor that the Trump people did. That's why I tend to think that the military aspect is likely to be emphasized. So particularly if they get into a whole to do with China in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, and then they get into a whole human rights thing with the Uyghurs, and if they start trying to build up a kind of an Asian version of NATO, which I think they may well like to do, I think that's going to cause a lot of problems with China. I mean, China really isn't going to tolerate any kind of a variant of NATO on the Asian continent.
Okay. Well, what I'm understanding from both of you is basically Beijing and Washington are actually going to have a lot of issues with each other coming up the next few years. And with that, that brings us to the end of this debate. I appreciate both of you being with us out of Madison, Emeritus Professor from the University of Wisconsin, Frank Inspach, and out of Budapest, Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, George Zabute. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Bafizi, 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 Ey shahidon rahe khuda, Ey karde, Bahre ehyay haq jan fada, Kas batre, batre ye khun paak shoma, Mi
In the limelight.
Just before the 2020 presidential vote, the Saudi embassy in Washington hired Off-Hill Strategies, a firm with a long history in conservative politics, for $75,000 to lobby for them through January of 2021. The article we're about to present you has been written by Marcus Barham. The piece is titled, Saudi Arabia Hires Over a Dozen Lobbying Firms in U.S. to Launder Its Reputation. The article has been taken from the foreignpolicy.com website. Please stay with us for more of Marcus Barham's article. Saudi authorities have reportedly hired more than a dozen lobbying firms to help boost relations with the United States of America and improve the Riyadh regime's image in the United States as new President Joe Biden assumes office. According to foreign agent registration filings with the U.S. Justice Department, Riyadh has used at least 16 firms to largely restore its influence machine in the capital, Washington, and in other parts of the country, and help boost U.S.-Saudi trade relations. A foreign policy report said the lobbying effort will be even more crucial during the term of the new U.S. President Joe Biden, whose administration decided recently to freeze arms sales to Riyadh pending a review. Saudi authorities are already in hot water over issues including Riyadh's devastating war in neighboring Yemen, its treatment of women, and the murder of the exiled Saudi dissident and journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul, Turkey, in 2018. The report said foreign agents hired to lobby on behalf of Saudi interests have apparently contributed almost $2 million in political donations to federal candidates, including to Donald Trump and to the new president, Joe Biden. Among these firms is the powerhouse Edelman, which heavily favors Democratic candidates in its political donations and signed a $225,000 contract after the November presidential election to provide services to the controversial NEOM megacity project that is planned to be constructed in the Tabuk region of northwestern Saudi Arabia on the Red Sea in an area nearly the size of Belgium. The Israeli regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman reportedly held a secret meeting in Neom City in late November last year. Edelman Communications firm was also hired by state-owned Saudi Basic Industries in early 2020 to provide strategic communications in a $5.6 million contract. Additionally, the Riyadh regime struck deals with companies seen as close to the Republican Party. Just before the presidential vote in November, the Saudi embassy in Washington hired Off-Hill Strategies, a firm run by a couple with a long history in conservative politics, for $75,000, to lobby for the Saudis through to January 2021. Ben Freeman of the Center of International Policy's Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative, which seeks to promote transparency and accountability in global relations, said the Saudis need to maintain their influence within the Republican Party post-Donald Trump in hope that the Republican Senate can help block any bills that might hurt them, like prohibitions on arms sales or withdrawing their occupation forces from neighboring Yemen. He added, there was this public perception that the Saudi lobby went into hiding following Jamal Khashoggi's murder. Ben Freeman added, but that's not true at all. What we saw is that actually they doubled down, giving money to think tanks and U.S. universities to help launder their reputation. Ben Freeman noted that the Saudi kingdom hired the multinational firm Gorvis to a $10 million contract just 3 months after Jamal Khashoggi's death in 2018, in a bid to improve its image and reputation. Citing the failure of the Saudi crown prince and de facto ruler of the country, who has presented himself as a reformer to Western governments, Andrea Prasso, the deputy Washington director at Human Rights Watch, said Riyadh used lobbyists to whitewash its image in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden has vowed to be tougher on Saudi Arabia than former President Donald Trump, who bragged about protecting Mohammed bin Salman in the aftermath of the Jamal Khashoggi murder. Several intelligence agencies, including the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, have reportedly concluded that Mohammed bin Salman personally ordered Jamal Khashoggi's killing. Riyadh has denied the accusations. Saudi Arabia's human rights record has come under intense scrutiny following the murder of the Saudi dissident and famous journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Separately, amid a brutal crackdown led by the Saudi Crown Prince against pro-democracy activists, Muslim preachers and intellectuals in the Saudi Kingdom, a Swiss-based human rights organization has called upon the United Nations to intervene and secure the release of distinguished dissidents in Saudi Arabia, including the cleric Sheikh Salman Al-Uda. Al-Karama asked the Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities to pursue the case of Sheikh Salman Al-Uda and urged independent experts to visit the imprisoned 64-year-old clergyman to examine him and report on his medical condition and needs. The cleric's son, Abdullah, wrote in a post published on his official Twitter page recently, the human rights organization called on the United Nations body to intervene and urge Saudi authorities to release the prominent scholar, Dr. Salman Al-Uda, who was arbitrarily detained, and stop the reprisals against his family members. The Arabic-language Saudi newspaper Okaz reported on 4th of September 2018 that the Saudi public prosecutors had leveled 37 counts against Sheikh Salman Al-Uda and even demanded his execution. Saudi authorities detained a prominent Muslim scholar, Sheikh Salman al-Ouda, on 7th of September 2018 and have been holding him in solitary confinement without charge and without trial ever since. Saudi officials have also imposed a travel ban on members of his family. A family member told Human Rights Watch that the distinguished cleric was being held over his refusal to comply with an order by Saudi authorities to tweet a specific text to support the Saudi-led blockade of Qatar. The US-based human rights group Human Rights Watch said in a statement, Al-Ouda instead posted a tweet saying, "May God harmonize between their hearts for the good of their people," an apparent call for reconciliation between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Earlier this month, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Egypt signed a declaration on the eve of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, PGCC, Leaders Summit in the ancient desert city of Al Ula to ease a rift between Saudi Arabia and Qatar, signaling the end of a three and a half years of embargo of energy-rich Persian Gulf country. In June 2017, the four countries, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Egypt, accused Qatar, among other things, of supporting terrorism and having close ties to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and severed economic and diplomatic ties with Qatar. A blockade was also imposed by the four countries on Qatar by land, sea and air. Qatar has repeatedly denied the claims and said there was no justification for severing of relations. Also, a court in Saudi Arabia has sentenced a Shia Muslim eulogist to 9 months imprisonment as the Riyadh regime continues its heavy-handed crackdown on members of the Shiite religious community in the kingdom. The London-based and Arabic-language Nabah television network reported that a court of law in the city of Dammam, located about 400 kilometers east of Saudi Arabia's capital city of Riyadh, passed the ruling on Mohammad Boujabara, a Shia Muslim eulogist, for practicing religious rites. The same court also imposed a four-month prison sentence against five other defendants. On 4th of October 2020, the Saudi regime forces arrested Mohammad Boujabara and eight other Saudi citizens in the Al-Asfar neighborhood of the Shiite-populated region of Al-Ahsar in Saudi Arabia's eastern province, as they were commemorating Arba'een, the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the third infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Meanwhile, the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights has denounced the prison sentence handed down to Saudi Shia Muslim eulogist and his associates, voicing concerns about the dire situation of religious freedom in Saudi Arabia and spread of extremism in the country. The European Saudi Organization for Human Rights slammed the arbitrary arrest of Mohammad Boujabara and said the imprisonment on charges of exercising religious rights violates international law. Saudi Arabia has stepped up politically motivated arrests, prosecutions and convictions of peaceful dissident writers and human rights campaigners, in particular in Saudi Arabia's eastern province. The province has been the scene of peaceful demonstrations since February of 2011. Protesters have been demanding reform in Saudi Arabia, freedom of expression, the release of political prisoners in the country, and an end to economic and religious discrimination against the oil-rich region. The protests have been met with a heavy-handed crackdown by the Saudi authorities. In January of 2016, Saudi authorities executed the prominent Shia cleric, Sheikh Namr Baghir al-Namr, who was an outspoken critic of the Riyadh regime. Sheikh Namr Baghir al-Namr had been arrested in Qatif, also in eastern province of Saudi Arabia, in 2012.
Good morning.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.